Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by Talia Lavin, who is the author of the excellent newsletter, The Sword and the Sandwich, exploring extremism as well as notable sandwiches, but also, even more notably, is the author of the new book, Wild Faith, How the Christian Right is Taking Over America. Thanks for joining us, Talia.
Oh, I'm so delighted to be back. As we were discussing pre-show, it's like every 4 years I write a book about why America is in the grip of the worst people in the world, and you guys invite me on, and we discuss it in beautiful Australian accents.
I'd really prefer if we could just talk about Rubens and things, but they won't let us.
Well, it's not to be super pretentious, but so when I was writing my first book, Culture Warlords, which is about neo-Nazis in the US, I really got lost in the sauce. I really didn't come up for air for a year. And since then, I've realized, oh no, when you're writing about horrible things constantly, you really need to, I call it, guard your heart. And so I've been writing about sandwiches this whole time just to make sure there's a nothing, it's not all bleak all the time. I'm like, cool, I'm going to write about the history of eels today. Just take a tiny break from child abuse and theocracy and all those fun things. So hence the sandwich lore.
Still good things in the world.
Exactly. Well, it's like when Sam Gamgee is all like, Mr. Frodo, there's still things worth fighting for. And I'm like, yeah, for me, that's sandwiches.
But they won't let us. We have to talk about the bad things. Talia, Wild Faith looks at the Christian right and the spiritual war for the soul of America. Could you tell us, why did you start looking into this?
Well, my prior book was really about the fringes. And I don't know if you guys have noticed, but because America is so big and loud and all hegemony, our politics tend to strewed outwards. And so over the last 10 years, this margin between the fringe and the mainstream has really blurred to such an extent. I mean, in essence, the mainstream is polluted with piss. And so I realized that, and initially this book was conceived as another book about the fringes and specifically a look at American terror. But I realized that it made more sense both tactically and in terms of providing the greatest amount of insight into what we're currently facing to actually look at the stuff that's closer to the mainstream and really the seat of power, which in this case is the Christian right.
I did notice, Talia, in the book, you look at this phenomenon and also argue that it's not received the attention it should, but is arguably not as fringe as it's been understood as being. It's a mass movement that has a history that only in the last few years has really, I guess, become more mainstream or is occupying the judiciary in particular, but all branches of government. And I guess, whereas previously some of these figures associated with it may have been dismissed as being merely a species of grifter or something of that nature, it actually represent a serious political project. So I'm wondering if you can talk about how the kind of, I guess, submerged nature of the movement and the kind of clownish aspects of some of the more prominent figures, how that relates to it as a serious political project that is perhaps on the verge of really taking over the US government.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the Christian right sort of been building power for 50 years, and that's a journey that I chronicle in the book. And of course, as with any movement, particularly within both political and religious movements, tend to attract their more than their fair share of very flamboyant figures. In this case, with people calling themselves prophets, calling themselves apostles, really leaning into this apocalyptic preaching in ways that can inevitably come off comical. I mean, we're talking about, I'm calling on Jesus to abort every demon baby, and this person is the spiritual advisor to Donald Trump. Cool. And yeah, if you are outside the culture of American mega churches, I know Australia has had its own, the Hillsong movement, which I think, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think it possibly owes some of its style to American megachurch flair. And you also have, I think Ken Ham is Australian, who is a big old creationist and creator of some truly atrocious homeschooling curricula. But that's neither here nor there. The point is that, yeah, you have these fringe elements, but really, since the very beginning, this has been a project about building political power. And it has been that way since the 80s, for certain. And many of these figures have been mainstream. People like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, but like the Moral Majority, Focus on the Family, James Dobson. These are figures that were really prominent in American politics in the 80s. And yeah, they were flamboyant and their rhetoric was frequently opposed and mocked, but they've never quite been like a clown show so much as, in fact, I think they've been given undue credence in American media as presenting the true moral guardians of America, which is how they position themselves always. They call themselves the moral majority and the people who really care about America's soul and ethics and all this stuff. But obviously, mostly this just means they're very weird and upsetting about sex, which Americans, home of the graphic violence, but if you is fine, but if you show a butt, that's rated X. That works well here. So I would say the question of how they moved from clown show to the mainstream is, I think they were never quite as marginalized as all that from the very first moment of them beginning to organize. They were always given this Heron Volke kind of credit, but this is a movement of tens of millions of people. It's been building for 50 years. And I think very much at this moment, what we're seeing is sort of the apotheosis of this movement, the zenith of its power. And what that looks like is the imposition of extremely unpopular, extremely authoritarian, theocratic policies throughout the U.S. in states controlled by the Republican Party.
Talia, in the opening of the book, you talk a bit about the Satanic Panic, which was this phenomenon in the 80s that I think there's a sort of an idea out in the culture that at some point around 1995, everyone was like, oh, that was a little bit silly, and woke up. But in fact, never really seemed to go away. For our listeners who might not be aware, could you tell us about what the Satanic Panic was and what are the reverberations of it today?
Yeah. Did you guys have one in Australia, or was that solely an American thing?
I don't think we really had it in Australia, but our Prime Minister did a few years ago when apologising on behalf of the government to victims of child abuse in institutions, did say that his apology was to the victims of ritual abuse.
Yeah, see, brain poison, it just knows no boundaries. So, but yeah, I mean, the satanic panic, which also it's also known as and has this profound overlap with the daycare hysteria is the other word for it. But basically, there throughout the 80s and early 90s, there were multiple cases where childcare providers, particularly those in daycares, were accused of not just abusing children on mass scales, but also doing so in communion with Lucifer, having these orgiastic demon rituals, flying, making children drink blood, sacrificing goats and whatnot. And yeah, it's quite bizarre, but it also led to some very real prison sentences for multiple people over accusations that you prostituted this child to serve your master, the devil. And even those who were not convicted went through these long and costly trials and, of course, had to endure these grotesque accusations, which no incident of ritual abuse in any formal, like, I'm sure, look, it's a big country and it's a big world, and I'm sure people have done dumb shit, but like, there's never been like a proven, established satanic ritual abuse ring, despite that being a very, very common accusation and the subject of lots of bestsellers and criminal trials and nightly news specials in the 80s and 90s. I have this, my take on moral panics is they never actually die. They just hibernate and come back at intervals. And so as bizarre as the excesses of the satanic panic may seem now, there are a great many Americans who very much believe in demons and demonology, in the presence of Satan and Lucifer, as manifest, not just in like the spiritual realm, but also influencing earthly politics in profound and very imminent ways. And we've certainly seen a recursion of this idea that public education and daycares are sort of ungodly, that teachers are grooming children. And because many of the people making these accusations are marinated in both QAnon and right-wing Christianity, there have been a lot of accusations of communing with the devil to influence children to go woke. And again, it sounds ridiculous, but then it's like, and here are 10 school board members who received so many death threats they left education, or here's this health and safety advisor to a school board who wound up being falsely reported to Child Protective Services for beating her child, which she didn't do, like stuff like that. So the U.S. is a very unhinged place, and people really do believe in demons manifest here. And so in many ways, what we're seeing is a recursion, both of the literal beliefs of the satanic panic and also its methodologies. And I think it's very dark to see, but knowing that history does help contextualize it and helps you understand it. Yeah. But like your kid's preschool teacher is probably not like flying in the air and sacrificing goats. That's just not something that's happening.
Probably not.
Yeah. I mean, like I could go into great detail. I think about the satanic panic constantly because I think it's such a apposite metaphor for like how moral panics spread and how they can really up and ruin lives. No matter how ludicrous the accusation, it can always get purchase. And the height of the panic was interesting because it drew in just so many different segments of society. Like, you had law enforcement, including the Department of Justice, that were pursuing these cases. There were feminist and victims' rights groups who were like, finally, someone is paying attention to the epidemic of sexual abuse that's been happening in reality in the U.S. And then Christian groups who essentially saw a protracted attack on daycares. And there were a lot of daycare workers who, even if they weren't directly accused, were terrified out of their chosen profession. The 80s also saw a precipitate rise in women's participation in the workforce, and therefore a need for more professional childcare. And so obviously the Christian right opposes working outside the home for women, and an attack on daycares as the site of unimaginable Luciferian horrors happened to also dovetail quite nicely with their project of keeping women out of the workforce. So it's just interesting to see. There are always lots of shades to a moral panic, and a useful question to ask about this and many other phenomena is qui bono, like who benefits, whose political project is furthered, who's being suckered in, and who's masterminding, and also the ways that fear can take on a life of its own and create monsters where only ordinary people are.
This fear and moral panic, the focus has seemed to not only be upon public institutions, but particular groups, especially the trans community and queer groups in recent years, who have also been portrayed as being or constituting a threat to children, which requires tremendous effort on the part of the Christian right and others to fight back. That seems to be many of the themes that were developed during the course of the 80s, and the satanic panic now seem to be replaying with a slightly different focus on groups that are considered as being, rising above their station, occupying public space, proclaiming their rights. And that's also, you know, very much a target in 2024 and in recent years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, trans people in the U.S. are facing incredibly precarious situations. In many cases, are dealing with legislation that it's like stuff about the bathroom laws. It seems on its face, oh, that's silly. But when you think about it, barring someone from a bathroom means essentially barring them from going out in public, making public space a perpetual site of threat. And so I think it's very illustrative. It's also illustrative of the ways in which the Christian right is inordinately interested in your junk, just at all times, just panty sniffing ghouls, the lot of them. This is not a pro Christian right book. I think there are a lot of reasons for this. I mean, as I said earlier, again, it's this one thread that's common between the satanic panic and the present is this idea of we're defending the children, we believe the children, while at the same time pretty much disregarding the rights and feelings and testimonies of actual children, like trans kids, who are like, hey, please don't take away my ability to play sports and live and just be who I am. It's appalling but not surprising the way people like this will persecute actual children. I mean, right now, a 15-year-old volleyball player is being, her family is having to relocate from Florida because she was outed as trans and people kept refusing to play the school's team. I mean, it's awful. This poor girl, just like at 15, having to bear the brunt of this really odious focus. But yeah, I mean, so the other aspect of it, and why is the Christian right so obsessed with trans people and trans kids, and but also just trans people in general? Why? And that is a question that I really set about asking myself. Obviously, this extends beyond just the Christian right, but when you've first of all, the Christian right largely sets the agenda for the rest of the for the rest of the right-wing movement in the U.S. because they're more organized and kind of better at conveying messages. And also, I wrote a book about the Christian right, so I wound up looking at that. And the answer is that there is, in general, on the Christian right, an absolute hyperfixation on gender and gender roles. They're extremely narrow conceptions of femininity and masculinity. And you can find those in literal instruction manuals of how to be a woman, how to be a husband, how to be a wife, that offer this incredibly restrictive Procrustean bed of just God created you a woman and here's how you live as a submissive helpmeet and whatnot. And being trans essentially represents a choice to kind of defy that incredibly strict boundary and that incredibly strict binary. The existence of trans people is a threat not to anyone's physical safety, but to this sort of hermetically sealed and deeply oppressive view of gender, gender roles, and what a man should be and what a woman should be. And so in that sense, the consistent, reactionary, violent attacks on trans rights and trans existence, often cast in these terms of spiritual warfare, of sort of, this is of the devil, this is aligned with Satan, with Lucifer. It does make sense when you consider it in those terms.
Talia, in the book, you also look at the subject of prophecy. When I think of Donald Trump with his literal golden throne and someone like J.D. Vance with his guyliner and his tech impresarios with literal blood boys, I don't necessarily think that the prophecies that involve them would be on the side of God. You might look at them and think, that's a little antichristy, guys. How have they pulled this off?
I mean, yeah, it is. I am not personally a Christian, which made it very interesting to write a book about Christianity. I think in some ways, not having my own personal Jesus to compete with other people. I'm not judging people on the metric of like, are you a good Christian or not? It's just like, what are you saying as you describe your Christian identity in politics? So, but that's neither here nor there. But yeah, I mean, it is interesting. Many people have of a more liberal bent have said, like, if you look at this figure with adorned in gold and if you're thinking about end times prophecies, yeah, like he's super antichristy. Like, I don't know what you guys are thinking. And I'm like, well, that's not my business. But yeah, about the closest I had to fun while writing this book was really exploring the culture of prophecy in contemporary American evangelical culture. There's a lot of it going on, less so in the officially recognized denominations, like Presbyterians aren't coming out and being like, I am a prophet of the Lord. But in America, there are a lot of the term of art is non-denominational Christians, which generally means too weird for any accepted denomination to take you on, too intense, too flamboyant, whatever it is. And so there are millions of Christians who are not affiliated with any specific denomination, but will just say, I'm Christian, I believe in Jesus, whatever you want to call it. And within those churches, there's this movement. It's often called the charismatic movement because you have these sort of very flamboyant, intense preachers and often people who call themselves apostles and prophets and will proudly proclaim that they are prophets of God and new apostles and this very intense stuff. And then you listen to their prophecies and it's like, Jesus told me all this stuff, and very coincidentally, you can basically hear the same stuff on Fox News. I mean, it's very right-wing. I literally talked to a prophet, and he's like, ah, yeah, God told me we've departed from the old ways, and that's terrible. And I'm like, in what sense, Prophet Steve? And his name is Steve. And He's like, well, trans people. I'm like, okay. So God told you to be mad about the same stuff like a bog standard Republican is mad about. It's just that you're saying Jesus appeared to you and took you into the past and future to do so. And you see this a lot. I mean, it's just a very, America has a very long history of these tent revivals and this charismatic way of speaking, speaking in tongues, this sort of ecstatic expression of religiosity, these altar calls. And that strain, that particular strain of religiosity for... I mean, this is the type of church where you might see a faith healing. And so people being, well, I'm a prophet and this is what God told me. It's sort of a piece. And one of the striking prophecies they have about Donald Trump, and you see this repeated over and over and over again, is that he represents the sort of latter day incarnation of King Cyrus of Persia, who was the ancient king that allowed the Jews to leave exile and build the second temple in Jerusalem. Of course, these people are like, yeah, we're the real people of Israel. And I'm like, well, some people had a prior claim to that, but okay. At any rate, the idea of the Cyrus prophecy is that Cyrus was a heathen, right? He wasn't a Jew. He certainly wasn't a Christian because that didn't exist at the time. But he was nonetheless God's vessel and doing God's will. So you have this idea of this flawed leader who heathenish leader who is nonetheless the instrument of God's will. And that you saw particularly in the lead up to Trump's first term, particularly after some of his more egregious statements about sexually assaulting women came into the public eye. And there's the sense of like, well, you guys have called yourselves arbiters of sexual morality and sort of been the prudity police for half a century. And now you're voting for this guy, the Mr. Rapist Adulterer Man. What's up with that? And they're like, well, if you look at it, Cyrus is referenced in Isaiah 45, and he would be the 45th president. And there are all sorts of fun textual proofs that go into it, but it is interesting. And now what you're seeing in the second term, and unfortunately because of the way books are, I couldn't quite get this in because it just hadn't happened by the time I was finalizing the book. But now what you're seeing is a lot of Christians saying that Trump's narrowly missed assassination attempt was a sign of divine favor, that God led the bullets astray, that the fact that it... And so you see this motif over and over and over again in his rallies and in among the faithful who flocked to him, that this was a very concrete sign and a miracle, and this was said outright at the RNC, the Republican National Convention, where Trump was like, yeah, I was saved for a higher purpose. And that's really where the locus of this prophetic vision of the presidency is right now.
Well, I would just say to them, Revelation 13:3, guys.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an Old Testament. I mean, I've learned a lot of the New Testament for this book, but grew up on the Jewish Bible, and I'm like, I have a lot of violent stories I could tell you, because our God is mean and fun. He's going bald, and the prophet Elisha, well, he murdered 42 children for calling him bald by means of a bear attack. But again, neither here nor there. I think this is why we shouldn't let Bronze Age texts define our political philosophies, but I'm really an outlier here.
Yeah, it's an idea.
It's just like the original subtitle. I like the subtitle of the book a lot, How the Christian Right is Taking Over America. That's pretty straightforward. The original subtitle that I'd come up with was The Christian Right, Theocracy, and the Battle for America. And this was sort of the lovely marketing staff at Hachette, who I adore and admire and really want them to sell my book. So I will say I'm not disparaging them at all. It's more just they were like, hey, why don't you just say something a little more clear and maybe not use the word theocracy. But I think it's like it's not that we don't know what a theocracy is. Like, there are plenty of active theocracies in the world right now. And they're like Iran and various other places, like the Taliban is running a theocracy. And just like, it's not fun to live in a theocracy. It's not a good thing. It's not something that we want. It really involves the government just being inordinately interested in your junk at all times. It involves this total lack of privacy. It involves just profound, I mean, literally, Iran has a morality police, and there are a lot of people in the U.S. who are just clamoring for that role. And I'm not a fan. I don't want that to happen. And I don't trust these people. And I don't think, and because of the way the U.S. is set up and the way we're essentially 50 sort of normal European normal European country size polities all mixed up in one, there are functionally already mini theocratic governments throughout the U.S., places like Oklahoma and even Texas, which has millions of people in it, where because of these openly Christian-inspired laws, where they're saying this law is for God, you know, we have women dying, bleeding out in parking lots, entirely preventable sepsis brought on by these fanatical, completely ascientific and totally religiously inspired abortion ban. There is no functional firewall between church and state for millions of Americans. And that's where we are right now. So the question is just, does this go federal, or was there an attempt to constrain it?
Talia, you also examine the industry around corporal punishment in amongst the Christian right. Could you tell us a little bit about what you found? And are we just going to have a bunch of spoiled children if we spare the rod?
Oh, God. You know, someone pointed something out to me that despite writing an entire, like a whole bunch about corporal punishment in the Christian context, since you guys seem to be fans of textual exegesis, I'll point this out. So yeah, I mean, spare the rod, spoil the child is not actually a Bible verse. That's sort of a 16th century paraphrase, but there are several verses in Proverbs in particular, which is a book of Proverbs, but okay, this is the one you choose to take literally, fine. And they talk about the rod of correction, and you should not withhold the rod, otherwise your child shall surely die. And someone pointed out that most of this stuff is in the context, because the audience for these books, the largely shepherding people. And if you think about what a shepherd's rod is actually for, shepherds don't beat their sheep. You know, you don't beat a sheep. That's stupid and ineffectual and weird. What you do with your rod and your crook is you guide the sheep. And if they're going to fall off a cliff, you will use your rod to make sure they don't do that. So it is interesting to me that the interpretation is sort of universally, this means we have to beat the crap out of our kids or they will die of mortal sin.
Well, I mean, if you beat the sheep, they'll just be confused about why they're being beaten, perhaps.
Yeah. I worked as a shepherdess one summer, and you just have to walk towards them and they'll run away. They're very stupid. You don't have to beat them. It seems really counterproductive. But at any rate, that's sort of a new take I was gifted by some smart, thoughtful people. But yeah, I wound up interviewing over 100 people who had gone through childhoods influenced by these Christian pastors and authors who really advocate for a quite brutal regimen of physical abuse under the sobriquet of biblical parenting. The most prominent of these is a schmuck named James Dobson, who's just, he's still alive, so I can't say all that I would like to about him. But suffice it to say that in one of his classics, for which sold millions of copies, the opening anecdote is him beating the crap out of a dachshund for falling asleep on a fuzzy toilet seat. And millions of Americans bought this and is like, this is how I want to raise my kid. Absolutely. This guy seems totally like he's got it. So as a result, since the 70s, I mean, there have been absolute generations of kids raised being beaten or quote unquote spanked, which I think people use the word spanking as a way to avoid saying beating sometimes, that it's sort of the separate, cuter thing, when in fact, no, you're talking about physically brutalizing a small child. That's what you're doing. And the only other context that spanking exists is a fetish. So there's a lot going on there. But yeah, I mean, these books, basically, the biblical parenting movement has for 50 years, and the books I read really span most of the 50. I mean, we're talking about from 1970 till 2017 is the issue date of sort of the most recent book that I explored. And they really just advocate to beat your child until they are obedient. And this hyper-focus on obedience, that the best child is an obedient child, and that's what you should strive for, is creating silence, obedience, and the outward appearance of joy at all times. And so I had people talking to me about literally being beaten for not smiling, and then not smiling after the beating. I mean, things get really sadistic really fast if the sort of opening premise is, well, according to the doctrine of my religion, if I don't break your will, which is a really, really common phrase in these books, you will die and be consigned to hellfire. It's a very sort of, it also stems from a very dour view on human nature, that sort of human nature is inherently sinful, and that sinfulness and depravity applies from the moment of birth, so that when a baby is crying, that's like an illustration of their selfish, flawed, and unsaved nature. And so things get pretty intense. And so it was sort of this tandem project of reading manuals with titles like God, the Rod, and Your Child's Bod, and then talking to people, which is a real book, and I own it, and it's on my shelf, and every time I look at it, I'm like, oh God. And then talking to people whose lives were profoundly affected by these doctrines, and also considering the way these authoritarian family models and obsession with obedience impacts a country where there is a rising politics that is authoritarian and theocratic. So I tried to look at sort of the intimate aspects of this violence as sort of an epidemic, and then also the sort of broader implications for the body politic, when at this point we have multiple generations and tens of millions of Americans who have been raised with and also raised to perpetuate this sort of violence, and subsequently empathize with the aggressor, be accustomed to a high level of violence, be sort of trained from their, literally before they can talk, into unthinking obedience. I mean, there are a lot of ingredients there for authoritarianism stew, and in addition to a sort of wave of silent and under-discussed human tragedies.
If only there was a group that had an interest in saving the children.
Right. It's like, oh yeah, we want to protect kids, and we want our rights as parents, and whenever anyone says, I care about parental rights, because I've been immersed in this shit for, you know, years at this point, my first thought is, you want to beat the shit out of your kids. You want to homeschool your kids so that, and it's not, I don't know what the situation is in Australia, but the U.S. very purposely over the past, again, since the fucking 80s, there have been specific people on the Christian right lobbying to essentially get rid of all regulation about, like, homeschooling, so that in a whole bunch of states, you don't even have to notify the school district. You can just take your kid out of school. You don't have to have any qualifications. There are no external inspections. Kids just disappear. And in many cases, if you are already living in an abusive household, right, you've just sort of successfully isolated your child from anyone who's sort of mandated to report abuse. And also, in many cases, this leads to just either profound educational neglect or ideological indoctrination in the guise of education. And there are very obvious legal remedies, but because the people who are most in favor of this type of policies are both litigious and violent, and also super ready to mobilize and show up, scare the crap out of state legislators, attempts by homeschooling survivors who point out stuff like, hey, this enables some really severe abuse and neglect, and also not knowing how to read. Every time these amazing sort of tenacious folks try to get a law passed, it gets sued out of existence or shot down. So that's another fun little story. The book is not entirely about child abuse, but there is some child abuse in it. And yeah, it's like, oh, we're here to protect the kids. And by that, we mean undereducate them, beat them, and also make child marriage legal in 39 states. So that's cool. You know, there's a very common, there's a saying among people who have endured and left this sort of culture that, like, there is no hate like Christian love. Obviously, I am perhaps not the right person to say that, but it is interesting when you look at the sort of what love means and what being loving means when you look at it in the context of these books that are like, loving your child means beating them, and for the most minute infractions. And in this folksy voice of just like, yeah, here's how to find a public bathroom so you can beat your child when you're out in public, but not weird people out. Or, you know, here's the specific dimensions of our recommended child chastening instrument. And I'm like, God, you fucking sadists. It made me so mad to be reading this stuff. And then also hearing very direct testimony of, I can't have normal relationships. I either was, I've been struggling my entire life to get over the stuff that James Dobson told my parents to do. It was really rough, but also a really meaningful part of the reporting.
Along with this violence that takes place in what's ostensibly the private domain of the home, we also have some quite spectacular violence taking place currently, in which the US polity is deeply immersed, and I'm referring to the war on Gaza, the genocide in Gaza. And I wanted to ask you, Talia, about the ways in which Christian Zionism has informed the Christian right in the United States, and how events that are taking place now are interpreted as a form of prophecy, especially in terms of revelation, the ways in which this kind of bellicosity actually helps to confirm or bring about a situation that many members of the Christian right are actually deeply desirous of.
Yeah, I mean, get you someone who looks at you with as much desire and love as U.S. evangelicals look at the end of the world. just the way Revelation pops up again and again and again and again in these sort of prophetic contexts. So, I mean, we talked about prophecy earlier. There's sort of another aspect to it where there is this subset of evangelical books that going back again to the 70s and 80s, but continuing to the present day, where world events are sort of looked at through the prism of, well, is this bringing the end of days closer? Does this herald the end of days? And it sells a lot more copies if you're like, this heralds the end of days. You know, his Jesus' return is nigh. And so there is a particular obsession with the state of Israel as what's referred to in a lot of evangelical contexts as God's timepiece, God's ticking clock for sort of his return. And in a lot of variations on end times philosophy or eschatology, if you want to be fancy, there is this prophecy of the conversion of the Jews, where Jesus will sort of return and convert. Most Jews will refuse him and scorn him, but a righteous remnant will accept him, and the rest will sort of be cast into a pit of fire, and then the others are absorbed into the Christian masses. So this is a fantasy of extinction, and it is a deeply anti-Jewish fantasy. But one of its preconditions, and therefore the precondition for Jesus's return, is sort of the ingathering of all the Jews into the state of Israel. So again, it's like, well, get them out of here. Let them go to their prophesied land. So in other words, Israel is instrumental to the return, the second coming, and specifically an Israel that is controlled by Jews and which contains the Jewish population of the earth. And so Palestinians, Lebanese people, it's so brutal because the issue is not even necessarily that they're somehow like aligned with the devil or whatever it is, but just that they're obstacles to this vision. And they're irrelevant to it, and therefore it's totally fine if they're rendered conveniently extinct so that this apocalyptic vision can then play out. The vision itself is incredibly dark about Jews, but about Palestinians, it's like, well, they're just obstacles, and so they don't matter. And so, yeah, let's bomb them into oblivion so that we can have this precondition for Christ's return. And so Christian Zionists, i.e. people who adhere to this kind of end times vision, among them John Hagee, who founded Christians United for Israel, an organization that has, I think it's 11 million members, which is significantly more people than there are Jews in the United States. Yeah, he straight up wrote a whole book called The Jerusalem Countdown about Israel will be covered in blood and the stench of bodies will be everywhere, and then God will come back to us. And so essentially United States, Middle East policy, there's concrete proof that during the W. Bush presidency, they sort of slow walked diplomacy with Palestinians because of this kind of prophecy. And a lot of the sort of unquestioned fervent support you see for Israel on the right stems from this blood-soaked vision of the apocalypse. It's super weird, but true. I don't know what Joe Biden's excuse is, but that is one factor in American politics where it's like the literal apocalypse is also very much a present force here. And that is tragic and awful, and I think also very demonstrative of just the ways in which mixing God and foreign policy is so toxic and horrible. It's like, you're not considering the human dimension. You're literally considering the supernatural dimension. And that is a view that is that sees sort of human life as more or less transient and irrelevant. When your stakes are this high and the stakes are the end of the world.
Well, Talia, what an apocalyptically depressing note to end on. But
oh my God. The funny thing is, a lot of the time I'm a pretty chill person, but yeah, my books have tended towards the horrifically depressing.
You can get the book, and to be forewarned is to be forearmed. It comes out next week. Wild Faith, How the Christian Right is Taking Over America. If you want to temper the depression with something else, Tully has also written about Hundreds of Sandwiches, which you can find in the newsletter, The Sword and the Sandwich. And you can find her on Blue Sky at Swords Jew, where
swords
come to sometimes as well.
I own like 12 swords. That is another wild compensatory hobby. And when the book comes out, I will be buying myself a celebratory sword of some kind. But yeah, I thank you so much for having me on. The book comes out really soon, like crazy soon, October 15th. And if you enjoy the dulcet sound of my voice, I read the audiobook and had a lot of fun doing it. And also, I do think knowledge is important. I don't come in with here's how we fix it. It's more just like, hey, here's what's behind what's happening. And then I think I have profound faith in my readers as people who, I said this about the struggle against fascism, and I say the same about Christian fascism, which is that the struggle needs your skills no matter what they are. You may think that you're ability to design posters or create beautiful crafts are irrelevant, but every skill is needed in a struggle this sort of intense and all-consuming. So don't count yourself out is my thought.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Andy. That's our show. Yes. We'll be back next week.
We will. See you then. Oh, reach out and touch fate.
Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white keffiyeh to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to keffiyehs.org.au, that's keffiyehs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
We We know you love listening to 3CR, but we also know that many of you haven't downloaded the Community Radio Plus app yet.
The app lets you tune in anywhere and share the station with your friends.
So, show the love and share the love and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.